Yes, it's a very difficult subject because the whole point in my own thinking about this whole subject in a book I wrote a few years ago called The Ideology of the Text, where everything is sort of subsumed or taken away from the roots. The interaction between theory and practice, for instance, is always being lost. And when you talk about use of the signs and images which actually dominate our world today, everything is dictated by the sign language. I called it the Las Vegas-like signs and images which dominate our world. And unless we can actually pull the whole thing back to the roots, the material roots which lie behind, hidden behind that process, we won't be able to do anything about it. If we just tap in on the signs and move forward as if we're floating moving in this world of what the postmodernist critics call floating signifiers, where there is no signified lying behind it, what we've got to do is get back to the signified. That is, the signified is the actual material underlying conditions which create the grounds which enable the media to function as seemingly without reference back to the fundamental forms what John was talking about, you know, the working class structure of sewage and electricity and so on, all those fundamental activities which make society work. And is it the media, is it the television image which makes society work? No, it flickers away at us all the time, creating an indiscriminate display of visual images, which loses the, as they said, the Falklands War. During the Falklands War, this was a psychedelic display of images on the screen which showed nothing of what happened in the Basel Road, etc., etc. Well, there has to be some powerful sense of the pulling one back to the focusing upon the clash between the invisible or the irrational, you know, the floating images and the roots somehow. I don't know how that can be done, but it has to be done, because if we don't do that, we're moving in this tidal current. We're floating along on a tidal current which won't stop for us. How do we pull it back? How do we change the tide? How do we push the tide round? How do we create islands which will get bigger when this tide is continually flowing in all directions round us? That's the problem.
Peter.
Yes, thank you. Christopher has just, in fact, emphasized in that reply to that question the importance of what he called getting back to material roots. And I felt that was something, that emphasis was entirely lacking in his historical review of ideas and literature and the struggle for democracy. And I had a great difficulty with that. I mean, especially one who is, you know, have a lifetime habituated in the materialist mode of thought. I thought that his emphasis on the world of ideas lacked historical, social, and economic context. There is one question that one should ask intellectually, ideas, of course, are terribly important. This is in no way diminishes the importance of ideas. But the more interesting and significant question, I think, is what makes an idea impossible at one time, but possible at another time? And you can't answer that question without sort of setting ideas against a background of social and material development. He said, for example, without theory, action is blind, without action, theory is barren, and there is no mention in that emphasis of the background of material conditions. He went further, I think, in two other things he said, where he said that Shakespeare prepared the ground changes to come, I think that would be rather, for all his work, an exaggerated view of the importance of Shakespeare as a creator of history, one of the grammatists. And he also said Milton's contribution to the struggle for change. We talked about that. Well, if you really look at what happened during that period, or late 17th century and earlier, surely the most one of the most important figures is Cromwell. And it's possible, I think, that if you're going to identify any individual as making a massive contribution to modern democracy, you've got to include Cromwell.
True.
But Cromwell himself, as we well know, and Christopher gave examples of it, was not a Democrat. He mentioned about the repression of the printing and the rest of this. And another good example, what had happened to Gerard Winstanley and the diggers. Outrageous. The other interesting thing about Cromwell was that he was not aware himself at the time of the significance of the struggle that he was engaged in. So in this connection, I don't want to sound too deterministic about this, he seemed to be acting out a pressure of background economic and class forces that he himself was not only not aware of, but dressed up in an ideology that had nothing much to do with what was really happening. So, in this approach, you have to come back to a much greater emphasis on ideas in a social context and the importance to our Now, coming up to the modern world of capitalism, in discussions last night, members were saying, well, modern capitalism to function efficiently and in a really stable way and to offset all sorts of protests and the rest of it needs a a system of political democracy. In other words, it goes with the economic system at that this time. So democracy here has an economic function. If you look at modern countries where they don't have political democracy, the whole development of capitalist system in those places tends to get distorted. So that is all I'm saying, that I have problems with his contribution because he did not emphasize the importance of ideas in a social, economic and historical context.
Do you want to reply now?
Well, if it's valid to reply, I mean, it may be better for other people to make statements to add to that, but I would only say this, that of course I agree with you entirely. I mean, if one is actually giving a proper analysis of the way in which ideas come to the surface, as you say, at one time an idea cannot flourish because of the grounds are not there for it to be able to flourish. Now, if one were to go into the question of Shakespeare's presence, you must actually analyse the way in which Elizabethan absolutism developed and changed in the last two or three decades of the 16th century, of course, because Shakespeare was concerned with that essentially. I mean, for instance, in 1599, the representation of English history on the stage was suddenly and imperiously banned. So Shakespeare was unable to represent English history, the process of English history, beyond the way he had done practically a huge amount of it already. But nevertheless, he was unable to go any further because it was banned. So what he did wasn't just an accident that he turned to the Roman plays in order to represent the same kind of collisions and conflicts which were taking place in Elizabethan society, like the Pouch revolt in around Warwickshire and Worcestershire. So that when you come to King Lear and the tragedies of that period, they reflect that process uncannily, with a kind of profound sense of relevance. So yes, I agree with you entirely. But then there's another point. Sorry to go on, but with Cromwell, for instance, Cromwell was
a great leader, but he was a leader who was perfectly well aware, if he didn't quite understand what was going on, he knew what class he belonged to. He was of the gentry, and he wasn't going to allow the revolution to move any further than the point it was going to, which is the reason why the agitators were destroyed at the Burford, and the diggers, the levellers rather, were destroyed. The true levellers, William Thompson and the true levellers, were all massacred at Burford in order to stop the revolution going any further. And that was one reason why Winstanley was so disillusioned and disappeared into, and one another reason why Milton himself was disillusioned, lost hope after 1652, because he saw what was happening. So from that point of view, one would have to analyse in considerable depth what was taking place and what Milton was writing in terms of. Yes.
Thanks, Dan. I want to go back to the question that Danny asked. But first of all, I would like to draw members' attention to the link we've got here with Christopher's contribution and Dick Donnelly's last year. Dick did a talk on the fetishism of commodities, and the sort of thing Christopher has been touching on with Echo and people like that is about this fetishism of ideas, so that people, with all the popular media, are being kept, and deliberately themselves keeping themselves away from looking at reality. Look at the soaps. People watch soap operas. Some people I know watch four or five separate ones in a week and keep up to, with every one, because they don't like the look of their reality. Now this is a sort of a commodity of entertainment which is being sold them, which they are preferring to having to look at reality. Now Danny's question is, are we losing out in this, in the sense that the message that we've got is look at reality. I don't want to look at reality. Look at reality. Now you can't rob people's noses in reality. So what comes to my mind immediately is William Morris. William Morris, I've forgotten, I mean other people can tell me where he said it, what it thought, or who said it, was on about educating desire. Now that seems to me to be the sort of avenue that we should be looking very carefully at, and it can't be done without considerable thought, I think. If, for example, our web pages contained something which caught people's imagination in that sort of way, like Newsroom Nowhere did, then we should be doing both things together. That's to say, we should be presenting a set of ideas about the nature of society and where we think it's going and where we think we're part of it, but also why it is worth doing, why it is desirable to be involved with it. I'm not saying this is easy, but that seems to me to be what we ought to be thinking about. And it does, this is what I have got out of the talk this morning, that people like Milton in particular, Blake, I think, rather unfortunately lost communication with most people, but we're definitely into that. This is what you should be looking for, not the repeal of the corn laws or even the removal of censorship. What you should be thinking about is making a new society. You've got all the power, you run society, you could be doing this. That seems to be the big connection. It does seem to me to be a part of an answer to what Debbie was doing.
Jenny.
Indeed, Cromwell was a bit of a bastard. He became a socialist. Things he'd done in England, Ireland and Scotland, he was a socialist.
Ah, absolutely, yeah. You'd agree more.
It was that class of the same level as Hitler and Maggie Thatcher, you know?
Yeah.
I think you can even conflict. I mentioned Cromwell as a thinker of freedom. Destroyed society where he attempted to, you know?
Yeah.
It's a piece of nonsense to put Cromwell on the same stage as some of the free thinkers of the world. You've got to put it in perspective. The thing you're talking about, I mean, syphilis was rife in England at the time. People thought that world was flat. Still pulled people's teeth as our medicinal purpose for cures. That's good, but I mean, I just computed why people sort of think it's Cromwell. Maybe in English history, the younger problem was that, but to me, he was a murderer, that's what I can say.
Yeah, not just a murderer, he was, you know, when I see a Catholic, I reach for my sword, he said. and the massacre of Wexford, etc., etc. But it's not just that, is it? Because in fact, you know, at the end, the drift back towards monarchy, that detested thraldom of kingship that Milton talked about. When one thinks of Milton, you see, and in 1660, the ready and easy way to establish a free commonwealth was launched in two editions, in April and May 1660, and 10 days later, Charles II landed in England, and here it was, this pamphlet saying, we should not allow ourselves to be thrust back into the yoke of kingship, you know, we should take out the elections are here. We should go out into England and revitalize the people of England against this power that's being brought back to us, and the ready and easy way to establish a free commonwealth, he thought, you see, which actually Cromwell had betrayed. It was a betrayal because he actually was almost accepting the crown himself, wasn't he? And then he advocated his son to take over his place, you know. So here we were drifting right the way back to the absolutist system, which nearly cost Milton his life. For 6 months he was suspended, he was in prison and was suspended in midair, not knowing whether he was going to survive or not. But he refused to surrender that power to speak out for the real issues. Steve?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I thought that very invigorating.
Can you speak up, please?
Yes. No, I think it was an illuminating and invigorating talk, because we're talking about democracy, we're not just going to tell us something new and put things in context. I think this context very well. On this point about the message and how one delivers the message, I think there's a very important point here, so we can learn something from it. History is a story. It's a telling of a story. In fact, in every other European language, apart from in English, the word history and story are synonymous. It's only in English that there's a difference. In English, there's been an attempt to objectify history as something over and above a story, something middle-aged that has a life of its own. But it doesn't. It's a telling of something. And actually, we remember a lot of things because of the way that they are told. We, you know, Christopher wanted to talk about Shelley. We actually remember the Manchester Massacre far more than Shelley's depiction of it in poetry than from any textbook. No one here can remember any textbook about the Manchester Massacre, I can imagine. But most people here, if they know anything about poetry, would know that Shelley wrote about it. Most people here probably couldn't name any significant textbook on the First World War, but most people would have come across the poetry of the First World War. The subject, it told the story, it conveyed experience. Now, you know, there is a point, which is a very important point, and it's a critique of literature as a form of telling stories, that Peter raises, which is you've got to be very careful about falling into the mysticism of literature, seeing literature as something which itself has a kind of capital L, as a conveyor of ideals and some sort of internal mystical awareness. But that's actually what Christopher was warning against, particularly in what he was saying about Umberto Eco. So I don't think that there is a... I think there's a danger there. There's a danger in telling any story. But I think the really significant sort of lesson in a lot of this for what socialists are doing, or what advocates of democracy are doing, is that anyone can tell a story. Any old bore can tell a story. Any old liar can tell a story. The politicians are liars who tell stories. Everyone's met someone in a pub who starts telling you their life story, and you do your best to move away, or give up drinking, or do them another pub. However, the art of telling a story is to find someone who listens, or, you know, perhaps to look up every 2 hours to see if the person's awake or nodding, or sort of saying, do tell me more. And obviously, you know, if you spent 90 years telling a story about the world of people, and every time you start telling them, they fall asleep,
you start to think, well, wait a second, we've got this great story to tell about the rise of capitalism, what it's inflicted on the working class, you are members of the working class, you must hear the whole story, don't stop listening until I stop talking. But of course, that doesn't really help very much, because people might say, well, you know, you might have a story to tell, we don't find it very interesting. Which comes to what Dan was saying about the message. Actually, the message is irrelevant if you can't tell it in a way that makes people listen to it. And it may well be that when you start to think in terms of telling this account of the configuration of society, of what the social system is, it may well be that it's a much more interactive event than we tend to think about it. It may well be that the real art of socialist politics and democratic politics is not simply for one person to tell and the other to listen, but for there to be this constant interaction between what people say and what is in the world outside, so that the person who has something to tell is constantly absorbing and sucking in the experience of everyone around in order to make what they have to say better. Now, this isn't some sort of great revelation or message. I'm not suggesting the Socialist Party should start doing this, because it doesn't. You know, that's why all of our meetings are democratic. It's not a coincidence. It's because if you don't have interactive events, if you, for example, just have had Christopher Hampton giving a one-hour lecture, brilliant though I thought it was, in most universities we would all then have to file out, sort of metaphorically, with our heads bowed in deference to the speaker who's talking something. Whereas in fact, because this is a Socialist Party meeting, we come back in the room and Peter Lawrence says, well, no more bollocks.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the kind of thing that should happen.
I'm being facetious, but the point I'm making, this is the interaction out of which, you know, you start to learn things, think about things, and ideas develop. And I've got a feeling that's the way all ideas do develop. I mean, I think this notion, you know, I think the answer to Dan, the sign has got to be rather more like an interaction, the kind of things that exist on the internet, rather more than the kind of things that used to exist on 1930s posters. I don't believe, I never have actually believed, anyone is going to go along to a 1930s style poster that says, you know, you are exploited, or we've got the answers, or come along at 8 o'clock, questions and discussion will be welcome. And anyone is going to look at that and say, good heavens, you know, that I must go and be told by those people. But I do think that this interaction between telling it straight and hearing it straight is actually the answer. And I think it's hearing it straight that is actually quite an interesting thing.
Yes.
I think literature, and I think particularly theatre, is a very important element in all of that, because I think people experiencing those things, a recognition of their own reality, which they don't often experience in conventional politics, which they find dry and essentially monological, one way.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true, but the point is that the kind of message, how do you get that message clear and straight? You see, what is straight and what is clear? I mean, it must come from what Peter was saying, you know, that there must be the interaction between the theoretical understanding and the practice of social conditions, of course, which lie behind it. Because without that, you can't have, if without the context, he was quite right, without the context, there can be no message which has any significance or meaning. Like when you mentioned Shelley's Mask of Anarchy and the Peterloo Massacre, it was the conjunction, the absolute ferocious conjunction of those two things which made that work. And of course Shelley's words have their significance and meaning because of what they spring from, not just on their own. They don't float in the atmosphere, which is what everything happens today, but they actually they issue out of the struggles of people's lives, those contexts that you were talking about.
After Richard.
A couple of observations and then a question.
first about what Steve just said about theatre, one of my sins. I got, when I was in Sydney, very interested in the development of the atom bomb all of that time, got in them. I was very excited by the stories of the lives of the scientists and what happened in their complexities of making decisions and the morality of it all. I was trying to sell that story for 20 years. I went and saw Copenhagen, and people were riveted by a story that I couldn't, in theatrical terms, that it was very, very difficult to make them understand. It moved me in personal terms. I was empathetic to it in a way, despite all my reading, I'd never quite been before. And it is a very powerful, in fact, Michael Gill and I thought of organising a trip for comrades to see Copenhagen, because I was very taken by that. So that I absolutely do think that it can bring things that are hard facts and history. It can illuminate it in a brilliant way. The second thing is just a little story before I ask the question, talking about the divorce between reason and action. My favourite ever example of that was one of the tales of Tin Eulenspiegel, where the house was built with no windows, and they said, we've got to do something about it. Let's take action. Let's get some sacks and fill them with light and air and carry them into the house. And this is what they all did. And a couple of people said, no, what did... And they were the fools. The people who were trying to stop them were the fools. The others were the dynamic, the practical activists. The third thing I wanted to say is about illusion and reality, and what seems to me to be an ever-narrowing line, sometimes almost impossible, just in the way in our lives it's sometimes very difficult to decide what is possibly innate or what is possibly learnt behaviour over such a vast period that appears to be irreversible. In the same way, there's a change in the line between illusion and reality. In the past, people used to go and toil in the farm or whatever they did, and then the myths and illusions were somewhere else. But today, it's almost like a dumbing down of the myths. The myths themselves have been pragmatized, so that they appear to relate to exactly what they're doing in their lives. But in fact, they're taking away the reality of their lives.
Did you want to?
Yeah. Well, you see, I think we're some members are looking for too much out of what authors can do. It's all very well quoting Timmins of Athens and Shakespeare's thing about gold being a yellow whore and all that. In fact, if you read The Standard in the 20s, it's probably one of the most quoted things that you see in it. And the party, it's not a new thing that the party would quote classical authors to try and boost their case up, and I can think of many examples, and no doubt Shakespearean scholars would do the same. But to be real about it, well, he could be saying things that could be interpreted today as being revolutionary. He was also a reactionary bugger, wasn't he? And he also pandered to nationalism, he also pandered to the myths and illusions and religious nonsense of the day as well. And to me, it's just daft for socialists to take a sort of one-sided view of this and say, oh, that was wonderful, Blake said this, but then what about all these other things and that? We wouldn't do it. We are contemporary, and I don't know why we do it, the figures in the past. I mean, the Communist Party were always claiming corpses, weren't they? They would say, look, Robert Burns wrote this, and he was one of us. Shelley was one of us. It was all pantheon and back. You know, the Aristotle and Plato were early members. And it gets to a ridiculous stage, and I think some party members are liable to fall into this. It's maybe given a wee bit of romance to a rather harsh, sordid, at moment unrewarding struggle. But I think it's a foolish one. I mean, for instance, if we're going to do that, why not do it? I mean, I remember members used to do this. They would take a film like High Noon and say, here it is, it's a perfect parable for world socialism. It's a story of courage. It's a story of how the accepted viewpoint, it holds back development because all the businessmen are prepared to put up with a bit of crime because it will help business. It's a view of religion where you turn the other cheek and how that fails.
In other words, you can see parables in everything. I've heard party members arguing that Donald Duck was the embodiment of an anarchist, rebellious character, and Mickey Mouse is the embodiment of suburbia, a lickspittle of the capitalist class. But I mean, well, if it's true, I wonder what Goofy's part of this is. But anyway, no, I think that the important thing of this is to get this. For instance, I'm quite sure that there's nothing in it. Only a Philistine such as me can say this. My only thing that I echo is hearing them being interviewed, in my view, talking absolute drivel on the television about the contemporary world, and seeing the film, The Name of the Rose, which is a terrific sex scene, I remember. But as far as any great profundity about Echo and that and its relationship, if it's there, I've missed it. And I think that there's... Well, I miss quite a lot of things coming. But the one thing that I'm looking forward to is coming with Coleman, who said, oh, if you think that Henry's going to go to a poster that says, you know, abolish the wages system, or how to get rid of exploitation. In fact, as I heard that, Fred went on, I'm quite sure he mentioned more of his own titles. What's the alternative? And that's the important one, isn't it? It's okay saying, oh, these are old-fashioned titles. What we want is a zippy, up-to-date, yo title. Well, what is it? Well, no matter how you think, it's going to be how you're exploited, how it's possible to get a new society. And in my view, as far as literature, the best piece of literature for socialist propaganda and advancing socialist ideas that's written as a sort of novel, and it's not been mentioned today, was The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist. Mm-hmm. But it actually doesn't give you out in parodies and things now. It actually says, this is how you live. Yeah. This is how it works. And while we may have quarrels about some of the so-called solutions in it, nevertheless, the analysis is terrific. It's also funny. And it's engaging in anybody I've ever given that book to. And that's a direct assault. That is the poster. We'll tell you how you're exploited. So I wouldn't lead too much into all these parodies and similes and metaphoric language and that. Beautiful though they may be, I think that their propaganda value is rather limited.
I think there is strength in your Philistine position, Dick. Strength, yes.
So I don't consider myself a Philistine.
No, I know you don't, but I mean, nevertheless, there is a Philistine aspect of that position. You don't consider yourself, but in the sweeping away the whole intellectual process is a kind of Philistinism. It's like saying we don't need all that bunk because it's all finished with them. It all belonged to the middle classes anyway. They all go to the theatre and they come out more comfortable than they went in, and therefore it's all pandering to that kind of process. That's the kind of argument you're talking about, that you know, all this beautiful metaphorical language doesn't lead us anywhere. It doesn't change anything. But in fact, if it is used in certain ways, it changes a great deal. I mean, you know, it's part of an argument. It's part of an ongoing dialectic process which goes on and on. And if one reads Shakespeare in the way in which I have tried to read him myself over the last, you know, 20 or 30 years, I mean, not as an exclusive process, but as a means of trying to cope with the contradictory nature of human reality itself and the struggle for something different. I mean, if you say he was a reactionary buttering up to all the authorities, it may be that in certain levels this was so, but at the fundamental level he was profoundly subversive in the sense in which he was representing the changes which were taking place on the turn of the 16th and 17th centuries. Now, you may say the turn of the 16th and 17th century is all done with, this is all history, this is all past, it's nothing to do with us. But of course, all these things have something to do with us. They are weapons, instruments, which we can use. We may not want to use them, but we can use them. And if we use them with strength and focus, then they have significance, seems to me.
Yeah, at least the thought that occurred to me, at least the Ragged Trouser Philanthropist, wasn't about Donald Duck. But that's just by the way.
Profound, that
one. Just a general thought that occurred to me. Well, you know, that I've been wondering about. You know, how much do you see people like the historical personalities like Shakespeare, Cromwell, Blake, Milton, etc. How much should one look at them and their work from the point of view of their own time as compared to, you know, 1999 or 2000? To me, that's a question.
That's a question you would, you would like to have. I think, as far as I'm concerned, I think the only place, the only way one can look at them is from the point of view of where we are and where we're moving, not from the point of view of their own time, because their own time is part of the historical process. We can actually examine it to expose things which were hidden, obscurities, in order to be able to understand better the time in which we live ourselves. So if you take Blake in isolation and deal with him as if he were nothing but a writer writing between 1790 and 1827, etc., then I think it's absolutely meaningless. But if you take them in conjunction with, say, a work by Trevor Griffiths, like his work Occupations, about Gramsci's the Turin Occupations, you know, where that comes alive, you know, where theatre brings it alive, or Edward Bond's The Woman, and so on. If you take those in relation to that, then there is an ongoing interaction between all the forms of intellectual and artistic activity, which is which concentrates and strengthens the movement forward towards a different kind of society, which we haven't got, let's face it. We've got the trivialization on most grounds. And when you isolate everything else and say, what we're interested in is the propaganda for a socialist society, if you say that, then I don't think you will ever get a socialist society, you see, because it actually turns everything into the level of a tract. Now, art is not a tract, you see, that's the difference. It actually speaks of these profound moral aberrations which exist, the contradictions which you come up against all the time, blunt walls which face you, which cannot be climbed and cannot be broken through. How do we do it? You see, and if you say, well, the only way to answer that is to deliver a socialist tract and say, forget about all the rest, let's move, let's march. Nobody will come with you. Nothing will happen. Because there is no way in which the propaganda will be answered. You've got to appeal on a much wider ground, and you've got to understand what is going on actually behind the surface. Unless you do, you've got to use all the instruments that are available to you, whatever they are, from as far back and as close to yourself as you can get, from where you are in 1999. That's the only way that you can be used. It's a falsification of the academics principle, because the academic is concerned with, you know, what Blake was saying was valid for those years of that particular era. And I don't think you have any right to go outside the period of history in which he lived, because everything is different, you see.
Yes.
Can I just go back a little? Am I right when in replying to Dick, you said he was sweeping aside the intellectual, and then you went on to put your point of view? I don't think you're right, because you're suggesting that when he spoke about the ragged trousers of philanthropists, that was not an intellectual activity.
Oh, no.
But that is the implication. And I think you have to be a little bit careful there, because first of all, you're suggesting he swept that aside. Now to the relevant point, but he did not sweep that aside. And I think I'd like to pick you up on that.
Well, I was talking about the strength of Dick's position. That was one thing. There
you're
is a strength.
You're very good with words, and I think you could have chosen a different way
well,
to speak.
Well, I'm sure. I'm sure of that. There are many
totally.
Examples. Yes.
Well, I think this has been a very useful talk this morning. I think you can see that in the quality of discussion that we've been having. It's certainly got me thinking in ways I haven't been thinking before, and it's made me see the information. I think what just